I'm Laura Vinroot Poole of Capital, and this is What We Wore. Josh Pattner has touched every part of the fashion industry. He's been a fashion journalist, a store owner, a designer, buyer, and even a professor. Josh's story includes creating one of the most coveted brands of the 2000s, Tula. I haven't seen you in, 15 years, maybe, right?
Likely.
Could be 20. As I was preparing for this, not that I didn't know it, I've always known it, but it really reminded me that, for one, I always adored you, but two, Tula, I've been doing this almost 30 years, and Tula, from the very beginning to now, is the most beautiful collection ever in my entire history of doing this business. And going through the notes and seeing some of those images. Oh, Josh, no, by far, not even close. And actually, if you ever have a retrospective, I have some amazing pieces that we could use. And my clients have all of their pieces. Nobody's gotten rid of anything.
That's incredibly, incredibly lovely to hear. I can't, you've lost me for the next 45 minutes. I don't know how to absorb that, especially given the company that you're putting.
We'll get into it, but do you not know that, like, in the context of fashion from the past, 50 years, do you not know that it is probably top five of the most beautiful things ever?
I'm stunned, and what a lovely, incredible thing to say. No, I'm not aware of that at all. What a stunning thing to say. I'm stunned. I think more that the women who loved it really loved it.
Really loved it. Deeply, yes.
And I think of all those connections. I mean, it's so long ago at this point, but I think about all those connections in every aspect of that time. But I don't think of it as I think of it as a very small niche that some people remember the name of.
Even if they didn't remember the name, they actually remember the label, because it also is the most beautiful logo in the history of fashion. by far.
Richard Pandisio design.
It means so beautiful. So let's start, before we get back there. Tell me where you're from, Josh. How did this all start? Where are you from?
I am from Chicago. I grew up in Hyde Park on the south side around the University of Chicago. Came the Obamas neighborhood.
Were your parents professors?
No, my father went to law school there.
Did you have any interest in fashion as a young person?
Absolutely not. Only because I had no idea what fashion was. I was not that little gay kid reading my mother's Vogue, because my mother didn't have Vogue.
Right.
My mother worked for many music organizations and civic organizations, and she was very focused on bringing music into public schools.
What was your first, inkling of fashion?
Well, yes, it's interesting, because what I was interested in from a very, very, very early age was being a costume designer. I wanted to be a costume designer I don't remember not wanting a costume designer, because I watched a lot of television when I was a child. There was the afternoon movie, 3:30 movie, and I knew all of those movies backwards, forwards. And I knew all of the costume. I knew Gilbert Adrian. I knew Helen Rose. I knew Edith Head. I knew all of those names.
I knew Adrian and Edith Head too. And my mother wasn't interested in that. But why did we know that? Did we wait till the credits and read and start to research it? Because I don't remember how I knew that either.
Well, part of it was that I don't think that I entirely knew what it meant.
Right.
I knew as I was looking at the movie that it was, that's where I fell in love with clothes, was really watching television without question. Or one that really got me, this is where it really started, now that I'm thinking about it really, it was the credit on Green Acres that said Ava Gabor's Gowns by Jean-Louis. But she wasn't really always wearing gowns. I like the way that they referred to her entire wardrobe as gowns. That was part of it.
I love that.
A 6-year-old or whatever I was. But that mesmerized me. And why? I don't know. I guess because I fell in love with the clothes, so I wanted to understand what it meant. Also, those people were a little bit in the, Edith Head used to be on talk shows.
Right.
I used to watch a lot of talk shows. He was such a character. I could do Edith Head in drag, actually. We looked very much alike.
Where did you take this?
I started sewing things. I was a very crafty kid, and I started making things and gluing things and cutting things up. And my grandmother gave me a sewing machine that had been her father-in-law, long deceased, who had been a tailor. He gave me that sewing machine, and I taught myself to sew on this old Singer. And that's what my life became for a long time. That was probably fifth grade, maybe. All I did was come home from school and sew things. Had nothing to do with it, was all theatrical.
Wow.
I made puppets, and I had a little puppet theater with a friend, and I used to get remnants from the fabric department at Marshall Fields downtown. That was a huge treat to go down there. And my grandmother would also send me boxes of remnants and old rhinestone costume jewelry
Yeah.
and just things to play with. But it was never about fashion. Then I was cutting up my mother's tablecloths and things, and my kindly father suggested that I get an internship at the Court Theater, which was at the University of Chicago, much like the way Harvard has the ART 4 or 5 blocks away from my house on the campus. And I got a job at the in the costume shop. In fact, I wasn't even an intern. I think I got paid like $4 an hour or something.
How old were you?
Freshman in high school. I did that for 3 summers.
And still loved it and wanted to continue to do that in theater, or did you move in a different direction?
Oh, I loved it so much. It was incredible. That was an incredible experience for a lot of different reasons. When I got to college, I went to Oberlin. I was going to be a costume major, in fact.
And did you love Oberlin from the minute you got there?
I hated it for the minute that I got there. And it took me a minute to settle into it. But once I did, I loved it. And it's still with me. And my closest friends are still from Oberlin. But at the
Oh.
very beginning, it was a mess because I was a city kid and I had applied there late. So I never saw the campus, is my point. We drove down there to unload me and drove right past it. Had to turn around and come back to it. I mean, I was used to the imposing University of Chicago, which looks like Oxford.
Exactly.
I just was in an urban. I was a city boy in a state of shock. But once I loved it, I loved it. And then I started in costuming at the. I mean, that was my course direction. Except that I didn't get along with the instructor, professor, person. Because I had already worked in a professional costume shop for
Right.
3 years, and it felt like a home ec class.
Yeah.
But to answer your question, it was in that class, the guy who ran the costume shop, he had all these subscriptions to magazines because they were part of the first time that I saw fashion magazines, it was in that costume shop because it was part
Wow.
of the costume shop library. Because there was a Vogue, there was a W.
That's the first time you even considered that that was a direction you could go.
There was no Vogue in Hyde Park. There was no Vogue at the dentist's office, at the pediatrician, at the hair cutter, at the newsstand. No.
What was your first thought when you saw it?
I was bedazzled, mesmerized. It's still with me. It was because of. Well, the whole thing then started because of the model Karen Graham, who was
Ah.
in the Estée Lauder ads.
Who's from North Carolina, by the way?
Oh, that's right. I was in love with her. And she was going up the Grand Canal, and she was in a penthouse, and Skrebneski was the photographer, and he was from Chicago, as a matter of fact. But I was mesmerized by her, mesmerized. But if you turn the magazine into the gutter, it would say Gowns by Tracy Mills. So we had an internship pro well, we had a work study is what it was at Oberlin. It's called the Great Lakes Colleges Arts Association, which was all those small schools, and
Yeah.
they maintained a brownstone, maintained a brownstone in Hell's Kitchen. And they dormed all these kids who came to do the art. You got a semester's worth of credits to do something in the arts in New York. But most of it was what they call the plastic arts, I guess, painting and, you know, traditional arts. I worked for Tracy Mills, who made those clothes.
And what was that like?
Oh, it blew my marbles. In fact, I believe on my first day there, Mary Tyler Moore was being fitted for a dress. So that already blew my mind. It was an incredible experience.
At that point, did it seem possible that this could be a path you could take and this could be a career?
Oh, that's when I was, yeah, that's when I was convinced. He did a lot of evening wear and what they used to call table talk, which means that your cocktail dress is interesting when you're sitting down. I probably started tracing patterns on dotted paper, or I would run around all over the garment, the last gasp of the garment center. And it's incredible. All those lofts filled with sewers, tailors. And I remember there was Metropolitan Teller, which was an incredible beat. They did the most incredible beating in applique because there was fashion and there was also Broadway. At the end, I designed some little beading patterns. That was my proudest achievement. That was also a very, very intense experience because that was 1983 and I was 20. And the small office, everyone had AIDS.
Did you understand what that meant?
I understood that I was condemned to die is what I understood.
Jesus.
Yes, it was an incredibly impressionable time, 20 years old.
But Josh, did people know what it was and did they talk about it? They talked about it as AIDS or what did they know?
By that time it had been called AIDS, where people would spell out immunity,
right.
Deficiency, you know, yes, they called it that. We didn't know. It was a very celibate time for me, young man in New York, frightening, and it was quite graphic. These gents had KS, which is a bleeding ulcer of the skin. I remember calling my mother and asking if I could touch a pencil or something like that. I mean,
Jesus.
Yes, it was a very heady time, but a very frightening time. I also happened to have lived by Dreamgirls, and in the early days of the premiere of Dreamgirls, and all the people in the streets at night was incredible.
So after that semester, you were hooked.
Oh yes, definitely. I came back to graduated. I came back to New York. I got a job in a Japanese restaurant in a sushi bar. But I think I got fired. And I took some sketch classes at Parsons because I didn't have any of training in any of that. And I wasn't even a costume. I mean, I switched to English after that. I had a meltdown with the other professor, with the costume
right.
professor. Then a cousin of a friend of mine knew. Oh, a cousin of a friend of mine was taking maternity leave, and they needed somebody to fill in. And that was at this really weird. Woo! I wish I could remember the name of it. It was on Broadway, not on 7th Avenue, so that's a big difference. But whatever it was, I took it. And it was a company that made embellished, oversized T-shirts.
Wow.
It was kind of pre-QVC looking.
Okay.
And there was one that had, remember how Michael Jackson used to wear like a royalty sash and medals? Except
it
was all bejeweled.
Yes.
And then there was one that was called Couch Potato, and it had a bejeweled potato sitting on a couch.
And the whole time you're there, you're like, how do I get out of here? Or like, what's the process?
I was revolted by the whole thing. But, you know, it had characters. And, you know, I'd seen a lot of movies about people coming to New York, people going to L.A., to Hollywood, people going to get their dreams in the big city. You know, I was ready to work. I was ready to go. So,
and how did you land at Donna Karan from there?
Well, that's the thing. It was, that was when I was
reading women's wear. It was during market week, let's say, like after the at the end of the first market week. So, but I saw it in the cover of the debut and the cover of women's wear with that Robert Lee Morris jewelry and
yes,
Mava Carr hats and those silhouettes that I was, I just thought it was incredible.
In 1984, Josh?
Yeah, it was 84.
Was it as groundbreaking as it, as I remember it? Like, it was it just absolutely radical and just completely new?
It was worldwide news. That was what was so amazing about it. I just landed in the pot of jam. I mean, it was I worked 100 hours a day. And part of that was because that's the way we worked. Because I wasn't being sexual, romantic, anything. I was just a horny kid, except that I was working 100 hours a day, so it didn't really matter. I was on it didn't really matter. It was a horrible time. But that's a different conversation. It was a very confusing experience.
Right.
Burying friends at that age stays with you for your whole life, of course. Fortunately, I'm still here and I made other things happen and I just worked constantly. But it was a it was such a fantastic place to work at that time because it was so exciting, as you're saying.
What was the most important thing you learned from Donna or from that experience?
Never take no for an answer. I mean, absolutely top of the list.
What was your position?
At first, I was hired as a temp for $200 cash a week to dress the models in the showroom during the market and get coffee and, you know, what answer the, you know, they just needed it. There was chaos up there. It was chaos.
Yeah.
And they just thought they needed somebody to get through the market. But I made myself indispensable is the point that I'm trying to make.
Yes.
You know, I tidied things up. I sorted this out. That whole collection in a very typical Donna style was made overnight. Nothing had a label in it. The samples were all getting lost because they'd send them out for editorial and nobody, you know, they'd never come back. These original Donna Karen things. And I just went and ordered. I found the production person and I ordered sample labels and had them sewn and everything. I mean, I didn't ask anybody about it.
Yeah.
I just sorted it out. I guess at that, yes, I was, even as a temp, I was working for Patty Cohen, legendary Patty Cohen public relations. She was so impressed, I guess, or relieved that somebody had jumped in there. It was Japanese press, French press, Russian press, every kind of press. Catherine Deneuve, Christian Lacroix, Liza Minnelli. I mean, who didn't come in there? It was incredible. That was a lovely, 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 lovely time.
Were you missing the design studio? I mean, was PR enough for you at that time? You were learning every single day.
That was a fork in the road in some ways because I guess I wasn't as committed to design as I thought that I was. I mean, I was sort of so lucky to be there that I don't know. I was just going with it. But somebody else would not have done that. Somebody else would have gone and been a designer come hell or high water.
Right.
I that wasn't who I was at that juncture.
So you left and you went to BG, to Bergdorf Goodman.
Well, no, Patty fired me and then Donna hired me at the end of the week. I mean, I never left. And then I worked in the design studio for probably another year, 2 years maybe at that point.
Yeah. And tell me what you learned from Donna in the design studio.
I wasn't a designer. I was the manager of everything.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, quite a predicament.
Sure.
But it was fantastic. It was fantastic, fantastic, fantastic. Donna was the most inspiring person that ever was. She was a force. What is there left to say?
What was it about her, Josh? What was it about her that was so different from anything you'd seen from anybody?
Well, she was so New York. And New York was so very new for me. But I'll never, for as long as I live, forget the first time that I saw her sitting on a cutting table in the back room, all swathed in cashmere. And she had those, she always wore a pompadour, kind of a 40s kind of pompadour. And she had all that jewelry, all that Robert Lee Morris gold shells on both wrists. She was carrying on, oh my God, you know, Freddie, you got to put it on the other side of it. I mean, she was so larger than life. Incredible. Incredible. And she was so,
oh my God,
she looked so glamorous.
Yeah.
But she was like the Jewish Eve Arden, really, because she was so sarcastic and so funny and so, you know how Eve Arden can really land a line, be snappy and glamorous and kind of hard-edged, like sort of hard at the same time. I mean, because Donna would fight. You ask me what I learned about from Donna, I could be on the phone with you for the rest of my life. But one thing I learned was to fight for what you want.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, as a designer, the way that she would fight with what's now called merchandising, but that word didn't exactly exist. She and Julie Stern, who was the president old time, Garment Center royalty. I mean, they would go at it about the cashmere order, the sequin order, the how many colors she wanted something in, why it had to be that way. Julie, you don't understand. All of that. They would scream at each other.
Where was that conviction from? She knew because she knew the women wearing her clothes and she knew what they would want? Or where did that come from? Because it wasn't from Anne Klein, was it?
Yes, that was just something she was born with. I mean, I'm sure that she learned a lot of gumption from Anne Klein. How could she not?
Yeah.
You know, she was like the only woman of power on 7th Avenue. And I don't want to say that's completely inaccurate, but I mean, she was a rare... On the design aspect, as a designer, she was one of the only. Anyway, yes, I think that was just Donna's. That was just New York.
Yeah,
that was where she came from. Her parents were in the Garment Center. Mother was a pretty known showroom model.
Huh.
Her name was Diamond.
Oh, I love it.
Something like that, Diamond Fask.
Oh my God, I love that.
I might have made that up.
Fast sounds
her,
great.
Fast was her.
Let's go with
name.
It. I love it.
And her, she came from very dashing parents. And a lot of those early collections were based on her, the shoulder line of her mother's jackets, the 40s, and that twisted turban. And the pictures of her mother were incredible. And her dad looked like, you know, with a fedora and a silk scarf around his neck. I mean, they were hot stuff. I don't think she knew anything else. Is what I'm saying.
I love that. So why did you decide to leave at that point?
I got fired.
Second time.
Donna needed to get me out of there. I mean, that's a whole other long story I could tell you, but I don't know how many questions you have. I was being a brat, essentially. I mean, when you ask me what I learned about, what I learned from her, there's so many. I mean, I learned how to fit clothes. That's another incredible thing. Nobody could fit clothes the way Donna fit clothes. And I stood there with her, you know, I handed the pins. You know, how to fit pants, how to fit a shoulder, why is the skirt hiking? I want it to be this. I want this strip, et cetera. All of those technical things, whether they were by technique or artistry or dressmaking, whatever they were, I learned at the feet of her.
That's an extraordinary experience. I mean, and especially at that time.
Incredible. Incredible.
Yeah.
I didn't have the same taste, really. And it was kind of getting on her nerves. Because I would say, put some feathers on it or something. I mean, I was really a brat. Oh, another thing I learned is one time I had done a little sketch of something and somehow it meant I doodled something on my desk and she passed by it and she took it into the design, to the pattern maker. I mean, that was a mind-blowing experience also. But I was on the ground pinning up the hem of something and I said something about my dress. Oh, that looks like my dress or something.
Right.
And she looked down and she pulled her glasses down to her nose. And she said, honey, every dress in here is mine.
Oh, wow. Extraordinary.
I just went right back to what she was doing and never held that. She was just a wonderful person to work with. She gave you so much responsibility. She was complimentary. She could be disappointed, but she was, you know, she liked to have a nice time. She was funny. She wasn't. She had no agenda. You know, she just wanted everybody to do their best.
So did it hurt when she let you go?
Well, she was incredibly kind about it because she said, I'll call anybody that you want me to. Who do you want me to call? So she couldn't have been lovelier about it. After I got fired, I said, well, I'd like to really try to design. And I'd like to bring you I'll bring you a portfolio in a month or something. And I sat in the bathtub watching Oliver North because it was so hot outside. And in between, I sketched all the time, which I don't really know how to do. I mean, I'm not an illustrator. I brought it back to her and she cried.
Oh, wow. Josh.
She said, "You don't know what a woman is." Because I think, you know, it was quite draggy when I had, I mean, in her mind, because I was doing like big shishy cocktail-y things.
Yeah.
But she really, she got kind of torn up, like I was part of her family and I hadn't got the message. But she said, "I'll call anybody you want me to." And she did. I have to say, she called Bob Mackie. She called Carolyn Rome. She called Oscar De La Renta. And I went to see Scorsese. And he was the one who gave me a job.
And so how long were you with Scorsese?
Oh, probably for 84 days or something like that. I was there for 2 months, I'd like to say.
What was the opportunity with Bergdorf Goodman? How did that come about?
Well, I went back to Donna Karen, as a matter of fact.
Oh, you did? A third time, I love it.
Because when they opened up DKNY, I came back to do the licensees because I could speak the speak. Because in that studio, they thought of me as the smart one.
Well, you were.
I wasn't the talent. I wasn't the drawing one. So, yes, I went back. How did the Bergdorf Goodman come about?
What part of the business were you in at Bergdorf?
Women's fashion coordinator.
Oh, wow.
An incredible, incredible, extraordinary opportunity. In a way, I still miss it every day.
Yeah.
At 62 years old. It was just, it was such a fine place to be. And the exposure of the things that I saw and the haute couture and the clientele and the purchasing and the just all of it. Just the whole way the machine worked was incredible.
And did it come naturally? I mean, was it a natural fit?
Yes, very much. And I had learned a lot from the gent that I worked for, whose name was Andy Basile. And I had a good relationship with the vendors for the most part. And I loved the work so much and everything that went on in that store and the level of knowledge that people had, all of it.
Yeah, it's a special, really special place.
And I loved having the red carpet rolled out for me everywhere I went. I can't say I didn't. I left Bergdorf's in 1992, probably. I was I went to Vanity Fair.
Oh, wow.
This has always been a thing with me in a way. It's why I've never maybe risen up the ladder in certain ways that other people have. Because I'm not at the top of any ladder. It's because I kept moving.
You have literally worked in every single part of the industry.
I mean, I always say I've done everything but be a supermodel.
Yeah, you have. I think you have.
I mean, that's sometimes how I feel. Absolutely.
Let's talk about Tula for a minute. I just want to give you my memory. And I think it was your apartment. I don't even know, but
Brian's
Brian's apartment, like a fifth floor walk up, Upper West Side.
Yeah.
Like it was so not anywhere near anything.
It was as absurd as anything could ever have possibly been. Absurd.
It really was. Josh, I remember just going in that first time and I like just nearly crying because I've never seen anything like it in my life.
Wow, I need to send you flowers and all kinds of things. I just can't, I mean.
You can't, I just hope you know how.
I don't think I do. I do and I don't.
Really?
And I'll tell you very specifically why, because it just happened. And this is why I answered your question previously as I did, which is that I think Tula was really beloved by certain women.
Yes.
And I don't think that it went so much beyond that.
But isn't that okay?
Yes, it's fine. It was a lot of work, but it's fine.
I mean,
but that was our intention, I think, because that was, I think, genuinely at the heart of it was a grand affection for women. But just the other day, a fashion blogger with 2 zillion followers said, "Ask me a question." And I said, "Are you ready for a Tula revival?" And do you want to know what he said?
What?
He said, "No, why? What could it possibly bring that we don't already have?"
Ugh. He doesn't know anything.
And I thought, wow, there you have it.
No, No, not at all. Not at all. Because I do this all day, every day. I look at hundreds and hundreds of collections. There's nothing even halfway approaching what Tula was. What was the hardest part about launching that collection?
Oh, my God.
Other than everything.
Oh, my God. There's so many ways. It starts to make me cry when I think about it. I don't even know how to answer that question. To believe that I was doing it, that's the honest answer. That is, there it is. It took me a minute, but that is the honest answer. Every day I felt like that, like the roller coaster.
Yeah.
The roller coaster was so dramatic and unstable and not mentally healthy. Frightening is the word. I was frightened that entire time. And I had some good times along the way, but yes, I found it very frightening. Always working while the wheels were falling off the car. You know, I mean, it was
right.
But I guess that's part of the legend, I think.
I think it must be, yeah.
And I do think with perspective, that's something that was initially so beautiful came out of all that insanity and poverty of financing, that it is incredible to me. That is incredible. I mean, that it bloomed like a rose like that.
Oh, it's Herculean, really. I mean, people don't understand.
It was.
Trust me, I saw it.
It was, and I appreciate that. It was Herculean, certainly on the part of my partner at that time, Brian, who worked like an ox carrying bolts of fabric up and down, you know, when the train would break down. You just can't imagine.
How did you know when it was over?
There were some cracks in it from the beginning. But there was a lot of conflict between us about what we were doing and how we were doing it. Let's just put it that way. Without being long-winded about it. In short, I wanted to move more slowly. I just wanted to have a rail of clothes that people came to see. And there was a lot of tension about having a show at that point. What we could really accomplish and how much it costs. And what were we doing? There was a lot of friction about that, but it happened the way that it happened, and that's what it brought what it brought, which was pretty incredible. So there was something at the root of it that was gnawing, just between two men. And then close quarters of the most extraordinary kind, because the fact the sample room was in his apartment and we lived downtown because my apartment was smaller. But yeah. I mean, every day I thought that the police were going to come and throw. I mean, we had three industrial sewing machines in the living room. Well, you saw it on a rug.
I was 100% there.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, completely insanity. I mean, the neighbors, all that sewing on top of your head. I don't know. I've never understood it.
What was the thing you knew about yourself more than anything after leaving that?
Well, as I say, there was conflict between us. There was always the financial stress, which was intense. Then what happened was 9/11, and that was a really fantastic collection that nobody ever saw. It was all based on Malik Sedaby photographs. I mean, now you probably couldn't do it now, but it was all African prints, but they had been Tulaized.
Oh.
And it was beautiful. So that happened. And at that moment, that's kind of what I boil it all down. We had different reactions to that and what we wanted in our lives and what we didn't. He, I think, became more committed to Tula. I became less committed to Tula. Let's put it like that simply. And my father had died and that had happened. And I just think we were at war and it was time to go. And that's what I did. And Amanda Brooks, who was with us, you know, in and out, musing.
Yeah.
They decided to keep it going. That's when they moved to Christmas Street. My point was that all of that coincided with the first article that I published, that was published.
I think I remember that, Josh. That's interesting.
It happened completely by fluke. I had met Tripp Gabriel, who was the editor in charge of all of the fashion writing at the Times at that time. I met him at some industry party. And we fell into a conversation, and I never met him because he wasn't a public person at all. He was like this mysterious Wizard of Oz. You always heard about him, but you never saw him. He didn't go to shows or any of that. So I met him and we fell into a conversation. We had a very nice chat. It was very convivial. And the next day I called him and I said, it was a pleasure to meet you. If I wrote something, would you read it? And he said, of course. So I wrote it. It was about the struggles of having this small business and keep moving forward, I suppose, was the ultimate message. But it ended up on the front page of the style section, if you could imagine. And I think that maybe at that moment, because I saw my byline and it was independent of anybody but myself, that was certainly a moment at which another door opened. It's the New York Times, you know. But before that all really got rolling in that very early, yes, I taught at Parsons for 1 year for Tim Gunn, who wasn't Tim Gunn yet. My tale about that is that Tim and I had a very good relationship. He could not have been more enthusiastic or supportive or just really let me, as long as I followed certain syllabus, he really let me do my thing. And I loved it. It was a fantastic experience teaching. I think he made it fantastic for me. He said to me one day, well, the Bravo TV is coming here because they want to do a show that they want to film here, something about a contest. And he said, maybe you'd get a kick out of it. You should come. And I said, oh, thank you so much, Tim. And I walked away and I thought, what is he talking about? Project Runway.
I love it.
Project Runway. I thought, this is the stupidest thing I have ever heard in my life. I don't know what he is talking about. So I didn't go.
What do you think needs to change in the industry so that emerging designers can succeed? Because it seems like it's set up for nobody to be successful unless they have a rich uncle.
Fashion has to be smaller. One time, Diane von Furstenberg came up to Tula and she laid up on that couch. And I gave her a. I went to the flea market and I got a crystal bowl and I filled it with cherries and ice like they do in Capri. And I gave her this bowl and she chatted and chatted. And I was going off on my whole pitch about being a brand and we want to be a brand, the brand, the shoes and the perfume and the Tula lifestyle. And she said, you have it absolutely wrong. She said, you have to keep this whole thing thriving, but very small. And I never forgot
I
that.
love that.
Absolutely. And of course, she said it, with the confidence that only she has.
Right.
And, would that be possible? Wouldn't that be an incredible thing to do?
Yeah.
But if you were to speak to the financiers in town, I wonder how quickly they'd be sending me a check. Because we can get going.
Yeah.
I think that's the only direction. And I think the whole thing is blowing up,
Yeah.
obviously. Fast fashion, how much does the Dior bag cost? What are people really going to pay? It's all just become a loony bin and it's eating itself. It's like anything. It eats its own tail at a certain
Yeah.
point.
Do you have any regrets in your career?
I don't have regrets as much as I have curiosities, because I passed by certain experiences that I wish that I had. Ira Niemark asked me to be a buyer, and I said no, because I was afraid of the math. And he said, I'll get you a math person. And I still said no. Polly Mellon offered me a job once to be her assistant because I was freelancing up there. Here's something I learned about myself. The reason that I said that no to that job, shocking to me to this day, is because I didn't like the position on the masthead that they were going to put me on. Working for Polly Mellon, I mean, that was when my ego was really young and throbbing at that point. What a ridiculous thing to have done. So who knows where that would have been. I feel that I have more creative to give, so it's more about that question because I
What's
do have so much. Yeah.
next, and
It would
what's the
What's
right?
next, and what could I do if I wasn't asking everybody that I knew for a dollar all the time? It would be interesting to know that. And I'm writing a book, which will come out in a year. It's called I Remember
I
Fashion.
love.
It's with Unbound Edition, which is in Atlanta, small, brilliant press, still relatively new. It is a collection of things that I wrote across all of those years of writing, and they are recontextualized from the perspective
Well, those things the publisher pointed out to me are in a way antique because all of those stories were written before the iPhone, before the social media, before the personal stylist, before the influencer, before the Kardashian. They're from another time.
Love.
So it's a reflection back and forth of then and now with a little bit of, with some biographical mix in.
Okay. I mean, stylist, PR, professor, journalist, buyer, merchandiser, designer, a million things. What of all of these, what stands out to you as the most important in your trajectory?
Define important, please.
Defining of kind of who you are and who you've become.
I am. I think at heart, I'm a designer.
Yeah.
Because that's what I think about when I'm not thinking about anything else, just what my mind mm-hmm. returns to. And that's been true since I was the youngest of young person. I mean, whether that means, oh, that would be a pretty print or, you know, thinking about a jersey dress, whatever it might be, that's just what floats through my mind. And for better or for worse, I have other abilities. And I guess I'm equally verbal and visual, which is maybe kind of strong. So I'm not sure.
Unusual, yeah.
But the one that defines me the most, I think, is making something. And in that sense, I think, and what I could say is that every job that I've ever had is the same job. That's what I've learned. It's all the same process. It's writing a story is the same thing for me as building a collection or styling magazines or doing visual, or it's all the same thing. You're making a point. So you come to a point, you put all the pieces, you do the research. Well, you're engaged with the subject. You do the research in whatever way that happens for you. You begin to develop something, whether you're writing the first paragraph or you're the one who starts with the conclusion, however it goes, or you're taking pictures and sticking them on a board, or you're going to the fabric fair. It's all the same process.
You're telling a story.
You're telling a story. That's all it is.
I think it's one of the most beautiful things that I've heard on this podcast in over 100 episodes.
Are you adopting? It's so beautiful.
What did you wear to the prom?
I went to two different proms.
Uh-huh.
I'm very happy to say. I went to my prom at Kenwood Academy in Pine Park. I wore a rented tuxedo from wherever it is that tuxedos were rented from. But the point of that is that I made all four dresses of the dates.
Oh, my God.
Well, I was still working in the costume shop at that time. So after hours, I got some Butterick patterns and I, you know, manipulated them around. The one that I remember the best was my date. Her name was Anna, and it was a spaghetti strap camisole with a V-neck, two pieces, and a long full skirt, not circular. A dirndl, I suppose it's called, a gathered skirt in the waistband.
Beautiful. And what color?
It was a jade green, a color that I've never liked ever since then, strangely. And it was a... It was a jacquard with little butterflies or something. But
oh my God,
I had some kind of jacquard. Spaghetti straps is what I remember. That was my first time making spaghetti straps.
I love that.
And then at the other prom, I guess a girl from another high school asked me about her prom. And I guess I rented the same text. Oh, no, I wore a Pierre Cardin blue cotton three-piece suit. With gold logo buttons.
Love.
Down the front. I wore a tuxedo. Anyway.
It sounds amazing. Josh, thank you for spending the afternoon with me.
Thank you for spending the afternoon with me. I need no more friends or any therapy for the rest of my 4 days.
Well, you've made my summer. What We Wore is produced by Capital and Balto Creative Media. The original song, Someone So Enchanting, was composed and performed by Britt Drozda. Please follow us on Instagram at What We Wore Podcast for additional content and show updates.
QueenCityPodcastNetwork.com.